Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight, remembering Charles Weldon. I came to him through music, though with the initial interview being just over an hour, music was the least of that addressed. As an actor, among other things, he appeared in St. Elsewhere, Sanford and Son as a cross-dressing thief on this one, and him talking about this led to him sharing a memory of when Red Fox used to date his sister. He was also in Roots, The Next Generation, and had a very memorable and very intense role in Stir Crazy with Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder. If you've ever seen it, you'd certainly remember him. We'll have stories about this as well. He was also in pretty much every TV cop show of the 70s, 80s, and 90s with The Rockford Files, Kojak, Law & Order, The Streets of San Francisco, and more. Charles Weldon passed away in early December 2018, about 4 months after I was able to meet him and see him perform. That said, we'll go into this program of fond memories, quite funny at times, talking about the music side of Charles Weldon, most notably known for Diamonds and Pearls with the Paradons.
There are diamonds, pearls, emeralds, and rings. None of these jewels show me a thing. I want only, only, only. I want your love.
First and foremost, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. We will be speaking, though, probably much more about acting than music, because the Paradons, a relatively short-lived group, yes?
Yeah, I mean, we were together, actually, all together about 5 years, because we were together about a year, a little more than a year before we recorded, which was by an accident, actually. We recorded, I don't know if you've heard this story before,
no.
But we actually went to Los Angeles with a band called Rick Lee and the Barons. And they said to us, listen, because we sang with them off and on around Bakersfield area, and they said, we're going to record, and if you guys come down and we get some time left over, we can lay some of your songs down.
Hmm.
And we was like, yeah, okay, we'll come. And so we watched, we sat there through their whole thing, they recorded a bunch of songs, and then they asked the people at the studio, did we have time? And the guy said, yeah, we got a little time left, and we laid down 4 songs. We laid down Diamonds and Pearls,
yeah.
The Flip Side, I Want Love, Bells Ring, and I can't think of the 4th one right now. And out of all of those songs that Rick Lee and the Barons laid down, and the 4 songs we laid down, Diamonds and Pearls came out.
Wow.
And the rest is history.
Wow.
That's how it all happened. Barons never got a record out.
Oh. So many of the folks from this era of music are East Coast folks. I forget that you moved out to Bakersfield when you were still a kid with your parents.
Yeah, I mean, I was in Bakersfield. That's where I grew up. You know, periodically we would go visit our family in Oklahoma. Bakersfield is where I was raised.
So the Paradons, it was pretty much, I guess, a high school group then, more than...
Yeah,
you know.
We started out, I was a junior in high school. Ironically, it was a friend of mine who was in the group. His name was Wes Tyler, who was my best friend, you know. And Wes said to me, he said, Charles, I want you to join the group. And I told him, hey, man, I can't sing. And he said, no, your sister sing. You can sing. I had no idea I could. But then I joined the group, and this was probably 58, 59 in there. I was 17, 18 years old. And we used to sing all around town at the fairgrounds, different places, the Elks Club. They had a club there called the Cotton Club.
Hmm.
Ironically, it's where Wes died. He got shot there after we broke up because he took over that club. He managed it.
Oh.
We always talked about coming back to Bakersfield and building that club up and making it a big thing because that's where we kind of started. But that's how it all started. We were together probably 5 years altogether. To answer your question.
With some of those singles that you mentioned, this was, I guess, on Milestone Records, I think. I think one of the ones you didn't mention is Please Tell Me. That's one that I was able to dig up. And that's actually, I'd have to say, probably my favorite, well above Diamond and Pearls and Bells Ring, these slower ballads and whatnot. Please Tell Me. That's the one that I really am love with.
Oh, yeah. Please Tell. That was kind of upbeat, yeah. Wes sang the lead on that.
Okay. Were you the lead on Diamonds and Pearls?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was the lead on Diamonds and Pearls. I was the lead on Bells Ring. Most of the songs that were kind of slow, and most of the time we sang upbeat songs, Wes would lead those songs. You know, I guess I had that slow song kind of voice. I don't know.
Gotcha. Well, I know that well after the group broke up, I know that Milestone continued to release singles of you guys. Did you guys see anything from that?
I didn't know that. You know, I would find out periodically because people would buy, would come and show me an album, like the Paradigm versus the so-and-sos. And these were like songs that we laid. Most of those songs that came out were songs that we laid down later on for Milestone, just laid them down. We had another session and we put a bunch of songs down, and I think those are the songs that they used because we left them, I guess, early, middle 60s, 1960. Our manager had us go with Warner Brothers, and they had songs, I guess, that were still in the can. And what was weird about it is that they always came out. I didn't really hear about them in the 60s. I heard more about them in the late, early 70s, in that era. So, but, you know, by then, I guess I was off into another whole genre.
Yeah, I'd say. Well, before we move on to that other genre, just one more thing about the Paradons. We mentioned Diamonds and Pearls, certainly the biggest song for the group. What about, in your opinion, or maybe the song that you liked the best, or songs? I'm thinking of a Paradon song that you guys recorded that should have made it as big as Diamonds and Pearls.
I think it was a song we put together, and it was a follow-up for Diamonds and Pearls. It was in that vein, and I did the lead to it, and it was basically, our whole thing was harmonies. We kind of patterned ourselves after the Four Seasons, Graduation Day, and all those songs. We always sang songs like that.
Okay.
And for a long time, it was people, when we toured, we would go to places and people thought we were a white group. Because you have to remember, in those days, we never put an album out. So it was not necessarily pictures. We were not on an album cover or nothing. So they would find out after we got there. You know, I remember going to Chicago and this place, what they call Cicero, I think. The women were screaming and the guys were shooting bean shoots, you know, peas at us on the stage. You know, a little thing that might be interesting. It was, I went through a thing a few years ago. I was talked into doing some of these doo-wop concerts.
Mm-hmm.
There was a guy out there, I think he was from Florida. He said that he goes around as so-and-so and the Paradons. I can't remember the name of the guy yet. And I asked him, I said, well, where did you come up with the name Paradons? Because there's no other way you can come up with that name. Because I know how we got there, because we sang in the church. And we were the Dons of Heaven in the church. And when we sang at nightclubs, we just turned it around, and there was four of us. So we said, okay, we're the Paradons. And so I didn't ask him, how did he get that name, Paradons? And I forgot his excuse. But he got in touch with me on the phone about having trouble doing concerts. And this is like maybe 10, 12 years ago. And I said, I don't care if you sing Diamonds and Pearls, wherever. It doesn't matter to me. He said, well, I just need to make sure I have your clearance so I don't have to deal with these people. It didn't matter to me. I was sitting on the subway. This happened a couple of times. I was on the subway, and these guys had come through the subway singing oldies but goodies and have their little bags out, you know, begging for money. And they were singing Diamonds and Pearls, and I was looking at them. I gave them a dollar. They had no idea who would give them a dollar. You know, If I would have said, you know, I was the lead singer on that song, they would have looked at me like, yeah, buddy.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
But I moved on at the time because I was very close to the radio station there in Bakersfield, KAFY.
Mm-hmm.
And so they asked me if I would put together a band. And what we basically did was open for all the acts that the radio station brought in the Bakersfield. So it was Chuck Weldon and the Kathy All-Stars.
Okay.
And that lasted probably 2 or 3 years before I left Bakersfield in 1966. So maybe about 3 years. So I would open for Tina Turner. I would open for Ray Charles or whoever came to Bakersfield. That was kind of fun. The whole idea of after you've seen Paris, Bakersfield was just not enticing to me anymore. I had to get out of there. I wouldn't be alive. And by that time, I had met this kid. His name was Richard Havens, and we called him Richie. Now, he's not the black guy you see, Richie Havens, that plays the guitar. But Richie was a white kid, had that look with the long blonde hair and the beard. He looked like the picture of Jesus. And the girls loved him, but he played the guitar like B.B. King. B.B. King was his god. He joined my band there in Bakersfield. He stayed in Bakersfield for about a year, and we played Chuck Weldon and the Kathy All-Stars.
Nice.
And eventually he says, Charles, he says, this is not getting us anywhere. He says, I'm going to go. I know some guys, and I'm going to put a band together, a really good blues band, and we're going to come back and get you, and we're going to really make it big, right? And I said, sure, right, of course. Long story short, I left Bakersfield. I got a job in a clothing store in Los Angeles where I worked in the warehouse. And I worked there about 4 or 5 months before I got this call on the intercom. It says, Charles, come to the front. You have a visitor. And I went to the front of the place, and I saw Richie standing there with a big smile on his face. And with a big bay window behind him. And I saw this convertible Cadillac with a trailer, and behind there a van. You know, it was like I left that job, got in the car, and ended up in Reno. And we called ourselves Blues for Sale.
Blues for
and
Sale.
And I was with them. It was four white boys and me. And we worked out of Redwood City. And we toured Hawaii. We toured Reno. We toured Vegas. All these places like that. Smaller towns. So we worked Sacramento. We worked all. But our main gig was in Redwood City. We stayed together about 2 years. And that's when my sister introduced me into the acting business.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and NPR One, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Tonight is a show in fond memory of Charles Weldon, who passed away December 7th of 2018. I'd met Charles through a concert put on by Affordable Music Productions, where he was set to perform Diamonds and Pearls, originally with the Paradons, and on this evening, backed by the Dukes of Doo-Wop. I'd interviewed him by phone a couple weeks before seeing him and meeting him at the concert, and while we did talk about music, most of the conversation was on his extensive acting career.
My sister was very close to a guy by the name of Bill Ball, who ran the Gary Theater and ACT in San Francisco. She was an actress, and she still is an actress, Annie Weldon. And that's how I got into this. She said to me, I would like for you to go and audition for this group, but this kid's just starting a new theater group. And I said, I don't know how to act. And she said, well, why don't you learn? Or something like that. It happened to be a musical, so the gods were smiling.
Yes, indeed.
You know, I could sing. I didn't know I couldn't act yet. that kind of led me into this business. The long story short, the same play was a play called Big Time Buck White. I happened to be on the stage with a guy named Ted Lange, who ended up being Isaac in the Love Boat.
Isaac.
Muhammad Ali eventually took the lead role. Mm. 9 months later, I was on Broadway with Muhammad Ali. I had been an actor for 9 months.
Whoa.
So that's how my life went. It was like, and my sister used to always tell me, she said, Charles, you have no idea how fortunate you are. And, you know, by this time, you know, I'm kind of big-headed.
Wow. You just really dove into the deep end there. You didn't start with the community theater and move up.
It's kind of sometimes it's about the luck. And I tell when I teach, because I teach quite a bit now, I do a master class. Every once in a while, I'll do a master class for 10 weeks. And I take maybe no more than 12 kids. Because generally when kids come out of Yale and they come out of all these colleges, NYU, they still have to learn how the business is, you know.
Sure.
I got a little reputation here in New York as being a good acting coach.
I would say with the roles that I know you from, acting-wise, they're some of the most intense, sometimes comical, but definitely always intense, at least the ones that I know of. I know that there was a break here and there, but I'd like to address some of these roles, if you would. One of the the earliest ones, I probably would have only been about 13 when Roots Next Generation came out. But I remembered you. I didn't know you by name at that point, but I remembered the scene in the barracks. And even at the age of 13, I remember, seems to me we're fighting the wrong white man. I remember that
By that time, I had been fortunate enough to be a part of the Negro Ensemble Company, which, ironically, I am the artistic director now.
Oh, cool, cool.
Shows you how life is. But at that time, I ended up in New York with Muhammad Ali being Buck White, and that was the most beautiful time in my life. I was hanging out with Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
We would walk down the street and it would be thousands of people. They'd have to, the cops would have to come and move people, and he would just, it was just a joy. But when that play closed, I got the call from San Francisco, please come back, because I had went into Hair before I got into Big Time Buck White again.
Oh, wow.
I was doing Hair. And so they were like, you come on back, we know the show closed. But it was something about New York. It was like, wait a minute, if I'm going to do this, this is the place to be, you know? And then somebody told me, he said, it's a black theater group, man. You ought to go and audition. And it was the Negro Ensemble Company. So I went, and it just happened to be a musical. Big Time Buck White was a musical. And I had to sing a song. Okay, I'm a singer. I got the job. But I still didn't know, I didn't know how to act. I didn't know that I didn't know how to act. Because even in musicals, you're very broad. Musicals
sure.
are broad, and you just kind of go, yeah, guy,
yeah.
you know.
Yep.
And I didn't know how to go inside me and emote feelings and stuff.
Wow.
And most of the stuff was comedy and stuff. And then I, all of a sudden, I ended up in this play that was a musical by Joseph Walker, and it was a play called Old Dodo, and it was about the Africans. It was done in segments. And I didn't know who these people were.
Okay.
I really didn't know who these people were. I eventually found out later on. Esther Rolle, if you remember Esther Rolle
yes.
from Good Times.
Yes.
Roxy Roker. Roxy played my wife in that same play. Roxy was on, was that Moving On Up?
Yeah, Jefferson's, yes.
Adolph Caesar, who became my best friend. Moses Gunn.
Oh,
Jared
wow.
Morris.
Oh,
Ron,
yeah.
who played Superfly. All these people were in the play. That's when I realized I didn't know how to act. But they were my teachers, you know. I didn't go to school to do this, but that was my school. I screwed up on stage, you know. That's how fortunate I was. It just happened that way. I happened to end up with some of the best actors in the world.
Yeah, you did.
And I just watched them, and I just learned from them. And they would talk to me and tell me, well, you know, give me pointers and show me different things. If I was doing something, they would come. Somebody would say, well, Charles, you ought to do it this way because this is why you're doing it. And I was blessed.
Wow.
I was blessed.
So you didn't have to go off and learn Stanislavski or anything like that. You had.
They already had learned it. They already had learned it. It was amazing. These people became my friends. Esther became like a mother figure to me. You know, Esther was a little older than me.
Sure.
Not that much, but old enough to where she was like the grand dame of the company, her and Francis Foster. I remember one time I was out in California. This might be very interesting.
Please.
You might like this story. I was out in California. And my agent called me and said, you have an audition. And I went, and I actually didn't end up auditioning. They saw my resume, and I was out of the Negro Ensemble Company, and the guy hired me. I didn't even audition. I found out that the movie was a movie called Rooster Cogburn.
Yeah.
So this was my first big-time movie, and I'm working with John Wayne and Katharine Hepburn. That's how my life was going for me.
Again.
I'm going like, what is going on, you know? I didn't have, it wasn't a big part, of course.
You're the bailiff.
But it was big enough to where if you saw that movie, you saw me.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's how it happened to me. I was just very fortunate and very lucky.
You know, actually, I saw Rooster Cogburn before I saw True Grit, so I caught you.
Yeah.
I saw the sequel
the court,
first.
Court, reporter of whatever you call me. I'm the only black in the movie. You can't miss that.
Oh, wow.
I remember this. I was out there, and so I knew I had this part, and I was going to work and with John Wayne and Katharine Hepburn, so I kind of partied too much.
Oh, yeah, of
and
course.
I went to sleep in my trailer on the Universal lot, and the people come and woke me up, and Charles, you're on. And they were hustling me in and putting clothes on me and doing watching my hair and doing whatever they had to do. when I went in, the lights were up in the studio, and you could see all these people lined up against the wall. Like, you could see, like, people that were stars. I can't tell you all their names. Mitzi Gaynor.
Oh, wow.
Anybody that was anybody was there to watch John Wayne and Katharine Hepburn work.
Mm.
And it's, okay, let's go, let's go. And I get in the spot here, you right here. And the director goes, action. And I stood there and went up. I had no idea my lines were. And I had this whole monologue that goes, you are Rooster Cogburn, sheriff of whatever, Arkansas. The director said, cut. And he came up to me, and it was quiet. You could hear a pin drop. And he came up, and he says, do you know your lines? And I went, yeah, I got it. Let's do it. He goes, let me hear them. And I did the whole monologue. And he said, let me hear it again. And I did it again. And by now, you could hear a pin drop, right? So he walked away and says, okay, let's shoot it. And as he walked away, this is a true story. John Wayne put his arm around him, and he whispered in my ear, he says, that fool don't know what he's doing. He says to me, now, see, when you see me come through that gate, start your lines there. See that camera right there behind that gate? That's going to pick you up, and you'll be on camera a lot longer. I watch all John Wayne movies. He calmed me right down. You know, before then, I couldn't care less about John Wayne, but after that, John Wayne was my hero. He just calmed me down. And he didn't say fool. He said a kind of a bad word.
With some of these folks, you know, we were talking about, you know, the intensity of this, and I was not expecting the John Wayne story, all right? Now, one of the other things that I remember as a kid, your role as Skeeter. This was in River Niger. This was intense, but in a different way. You were this strung out.
Yeah, it was a junkie.
Yeah.
It was a junkie, you know? And I had to research this guy, you know, because, of course, we smoked a little weed and stuff.
Sure.
But I wasn't into drugs at all.
No.
And I was living in New York. We had already been on Broadway for about 9 months. I was with it before I went back out. I was the only one in the movie that had ever done the play.
Oh, wow.
They got Sicily. Nice. They got James Earl Lucas, Glenn Turman. They all saw the play, but none of them was in the play.
Wow.
So my whole thing was that, Charles, you got to uphold for us. You got to be the guy that goes in there and knocks it out of the park. So it was up to me to be as good as I could be. And I knew the character fairly well because I did it for 9 months on Broadway.
You did Skeeter for 9 months on Broadway.
Yeah, but I had already did it almost. We ran it almost a year before we went to Broadway.
Okay.
So it was in my blood. I had an experience with this beautiful girl. She was from Connecticut, and she was waiting for me after I came out of the theater, and she told me her name. I can't remember it now. We had a drink, and she asked me, she said, you got something we can get high on? And I was like, yeah, I got some weed. I didn't say that to her, but I took her back to my apartment. I was living in the East Village then. She thought I was a real junkie.
Oh, my God.
We got to my apartment, and I started rolling up a joint.
Yeah.
She was going, is that all you have? And I went, yeah, what did you think? And she was like, well, I thought, you know, I thought that you did heroin. I said, no, honey, I'm acting. I really am acting. She just abruptly changed. She didn't get angry or anything. She just said, well, that's what I wanted to get high. If you don't have it, I don't think I should be here.
Oh, whoa.
I was like, wow. And she left.
Wow.
She left. She was like, she was there high. She thought I was a real junkie. Well, I told people the story. I told some of the cast the next day. They were going like, wow, who was that fine chick you was with? And I said, man, she wanted to get high. She didn't want to get me. And they were saying, well, maybe she didn't want to get you. Maybe she was a narc or something. I'm going, I don't know what she was, but I didn't have what you wanted.
Yeah.
But, that was an intense part.
Yeah, I would say. So you did it on stage for a long time before the actual film. You did a lot of research on that. Did you go out and speak with people who were, let's say, suffering from the needle?
No, you didn't. I didn't necessarily speak with people because, I mean, how do you do that? Especially at that point in my career, I wasn't that bright.
Okay.
But I would see those guys on the street, and I would talk to recovering addicts about the experiences and stuff. But what I mainly did was watched this one guy who stands out in my mind was outside the theater there on 47th Street. He was just nodding, and he looked up at me. He just came out of the nod, and he looked up over at me, and he said, "Man, man." He says, "Look at that." He's pointing toward the title. And I said, yeah. And there's a picture right there of me. I thought he was put it together, but he didn't care about that. he looked at me and he said, "Look at that, the River Nigger." Mm. And I said, no, brother. No. It's the River Niger. You know, it's no two G's. Mm. He said, "Same MF thing." So I don't know. That was like the God saying, "Okay, watch this guy. Because I think I got better just knowing how to do it. You know, you see it happening at that time in the East Village. There were junkies everywhere.
Gotcha.
The East Village is kind of foo-foo now. East Village is almost, you know, Chelsea.
Yeah.
But at the time, man, you know, you had to watch your back because you might get robbed, you know.
Sure.
This was like 71, 72. So I had the people. I just watched people, basically.
Well, that was
how I learned it.
Like Miles Davis went to Juilliard, but his real education was in the streets.
Yeah, yeah. I had an experience with Miles, too, early on.
Oh, did you?
Miles was a friend with Ali.
Yeah.
And he loved the play. He loved Big Time Buck White.
Mm.
So Miles hired us. The first act, Ali is not in the first act. Ali's character, who was Buck White, who was the leader of the little group, he would come at the end of the first act, and he would walk down through the audience, and we would sing this song, Big Time Buck White, and mm-hmm. the music, the orchestra, Big Time Buck White. And by the time he came up on stage, the lights would fade, and it would be the end of Act One. Miles hired us just to do the first act, so we worked with him for 2 weeks at the Village Gate during the first act of Buck White. And Miles is a friend of mine. His name was Ted Ross. And Ted played the lion in The Wiz. Ted was a good actor. And he's a good singer. But Ted was a braggart kind of guy. I liked Ted. He was a good friend. He was in Big Time Buck White when we were in San Francisco, too. He came in later and took over the role of Big Time Buck White in San Francisco. But he said to me, he said, "You want to meet Miles Davis?" You know? And so he said, "Yeah." I said, "Yeah, man, it'd be really cool to meet Miles, you know." So he went and he stopped and got a couple of bottles of champagne, and we're walking in Miles' dressing room. I'm behind him. And before I could even see Miles, I heard his voice. He said, "Get that shit out of here." "Get that shit out of here. You know I don't like that shit." And Ted is a black man. He turned totally red. So I ended up in there. Miles, he didn't call me Charles or nothing. He says, "Rubber band, come on in, man." And I sat there and talked to Miles, and he was great, man. We talked. We had the same birthday and everything.
Oh, really?
That's June 1st.
So just to get this, while Miles was playing, he'd be hired to play at the Village Gate.
Uh-huh.
But so you were hired. People go to see Miles for a musical gig, and it opens with Act One of Big Time Buck White.
Act One of Big Time Buck White, yeah. I watched him every night. Every night I could, I watched. I mean, he had a great group. And Miles would, you know, he'd play and then walk off stage and come stand over there and talk shit. Go back and play on, you know, he never stayed on the stage all the time.
Right, right. Some of my favorite years of Miles are the late 50s going into the early 60s, and so that would have been just the time to see him. So I have to say that is incredible.
Yeah. I didn't, you know, I wasn't into jazz at all.
Mm,
but,
okay.
You know, I knew of him.
Right.
I definitely knew of him. And when we did Buck White, it didn't run long because at the time America was down on Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
So we ran about 3 months. Mostly the people that came that I remember are the Frank Sinatras. We did Ella Sullivan's show. All the stars basically came. And it was a role in it. I played the Sergeant of Arms in Buck White. The character's name was Rubber Band. And at the time I had muscles. Had a big natural, and I wore a cage and a leather outfit.
Yeah.
And it was a song in there where we would go out in the audience. the song would tap the plate, feel so great when you donate, tap the plate. And we would collect money from people in the audience.
Oh, cool. Oh, wow.
And if they didn't go in their pocket and give us money, whoever the character was would say, rubber band. And I would go and stand over them and intimidate them, you know. So I would be standing over people like Frank Sinatra with a snarl on my face until he came up with the money. And it worked. And we would collect like $400 or $500 a night, you know.
Oh, my gosh.
Ridiculous, and it was just money we would party on, you know.
Is this the same face you recalled for Blade in Stir Crazy, that kind of crazy
look?
Oh,
yeah, no doubt about it. Well, Douglas used to always use me to be the bad guy on stage.
Yeah.
And when I auditioned for Blade, I went in there. Of course, I'd learned the lines, but I didn't know what I was going to do yet.
Okay.
I just went in there with this attitude, and this guy was in prison. And okay, and I'm going to go from there. And I just did what I did. I don't know why I did it that way, but I remember distinctly that Sidney started laughing. And in my mind, I was saying, oh, shit, I screwed this up. I don't know why I thought that. But he was laughing his butt off because I didn't know he was supposed to laugh. You know, I was trying to scare somebody. But that's what he was laughing at. He gave me the job. I was like, whoa. You know, I didn't know nothing about rodeo. When I did that whole thing about, you know, hook to the left, side to the side, and it all came out of me right there in rehearsal. I mean, in the audition. I didn't do that before I got there. You know, I didn't have that planned. It just came out.
So I will have to mention for folks that are listening to this, they just need to go to the role where there's a guy here, and this is Charles Weldon, who's telling Richard Pryor that being a rodeo clown is not necessarily a funny thing. It's a dangerous thing. And Richard needs to find the right word
Richard
that will set the bull off.
Yeah, Richard was a good guy. Hung out with him a while. That's a whole nother story.
Well, I've got time for whole nother stories here. And that's the thing about Richard, too, is he wasn't somebody who went right into acting. Started off as a comedian, so it wasn't necessarily his direct path. He'd been in a couple of roles, or a few roles, by the time Stir Crazy.
Yeah, and he did a couple of roles that was very dramatic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But by this time, I think a lot of it was if you worked with them, he did work with Gene a lot. And if you were around somebody that's been in the business and you talk the business, you kind of learn. I think that was part of it. You learn that you just basically come with what's inside you for whatever character you're playing, but you try to make it as honest to yourself as you can, as opposed to trying to emulate somebody else. It has to come from you. It has to come from inside you, inside your brain, what you know. I think maybe he got that from Gene Wilder, because him and Gene, they didn't really hang out. I hung out with Richard more than Gene did, because we were in that prison for almost 7 weeks. We were supposed to be there, too.
Oh, wow.
But they didn't take into consideration that they had 3 checks a day, prisoner checks, which prisoners had to go to their cells and be counted. They had that 3 times a day. That by the time they did that, the whole 2 hours would pass, maybe. So we were there a lot longer than we were supposed to be. You saw that film, right? Because you told me you saw me in the film.
Yeah, multiple times. Multiple times.
All the guys in my gang were prisoners. One guy had lines, and I think he was an actor. But the rest of the guys were actual prisoners. They were like in there for murder or robbery or whatever they were in there for.
Oh, wow.
But they, of course, were on good behavior to even be there. There's about 300 people in that prison who worked on that film as extras. And Sidney would pick out who he wanted in the background of each scene that he shot. Like, they would be playing basketball. It would be all kinds of Mexican, white, black on each team. But as soon as he would cut it and set up for another scene, they would all kind of go back to their own kind.
Mm.
You know? It was very interesting. And Richard would always be late.
Oh.
He would be late and would have to wait for Richard. Eventually, they started flying him in on a helicopter. True story.
Hmm?
Richard would come, and that helicopter would sit down in the middle of Arizona State Prison Yard. And everybody would be around, all the prisoners. We had to wear these yellow vests when we weren't working to identify that we were not prisoners.
Sure.
The helicopter would sit down in the middle of that prison yard. Richard would come off that helicopter and say, "Get back, mother! Get back!" And they would laugh, man. They were like, they would just laugh their butts off, you know? And it was like, because Richard was telling them, "You ain't getting out of here on this thing." He made a whole joke out of it, you know? They loved it, though. They loved it. They made $25 a day. So, hey, that was good money for them, you know?
Yeah, I'd say.
Can you imagine being in prison for whatever and making $25 a day? And we ended up staying there for 6 weeks or so. So they made a little money.
I really did not realize, as many times as I've seen that movie, that it was a real prison. I didn't realize until this moment.
Oh, no, we were inside Arizona State Penitentiary. It's still there. That's where we shot it. We shot it right on the main yard.
Okay.
And the guy that took care of us was the underwarden. He was an amazing guy. This guy could change his, he could smile and be really nice. And one of those prisoners would do something or step out of line. This guy could change. Boy, if you could act, I used to watch this guy. And I said, if I could do that, I would be the greatest actor in the world.
Wow.
He could just change to where his persona was like, you don't go there. Don't you go there. And these prisoners, I guess, knew it. Because they would start, like, wanting to talk to us, and they'd be walking along with us, and they shouldn't have done that. And he would say something that they would just, like, stop in their tracks, buddy.
Mm.
And he would say to me, because these guys were in my gang, and he knew I had to have a conversation with them.
Yeah.
He said, now, they're going to ask you to take stuff out. They're going to give you phone numbers, and they're going to do this and that.
Mm.
Don't you do it.
Yeah.
So I didn't. But they would do things like, "So, man, what are we supposed to be? We're supposed to be badder than Richard and Gene." And I say, yeah, we're supposed to be badder than them. He say, like, "We should be up in their face, brother."
Mm-hmm.
And I would go like, "Oh, no, don't worry about that, Sidney." Okay, I'd say, plus, this is a comedy. And they were like, "I don't see nothing funny." I don't know, what am I going to say to that? I just go, well, you know.
Right.
I had to keep explaining to these guys about why we were doing what we were doing. You know, they didn't quite understand it. Like, well, you know, they wanted to really be better than guys. Let's beat them up.
It's abandoned realism for a second, folks. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Wow. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and NPR One, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Back now to Charles Weldon. Now, at one point, after having a wonderful acting career under his belt, he drifted away from acting and was driving a truck for a living. Just ahead, how Steve Winwood's Back in the High Life Again got Weldon back to acting. Also, how double parking his tractor and trailer in front of an office so he can run in and audition got him the part without having to audition.
Oh, man. That was a tough part of my life. I told you about the great Adolph Caesar, who was my mentor and my best friend for over 20 years.
Yes.
He basically taught me the game of acting because he was a great actor. And Adolph and I were like, we were partners, man. Mm-hmm. We were partners. And when he died, I went through a period. They kind of took it out on me in a lot of ways. I say they, you know, his wife, of course. I mean, it must have been my fault. He was out in California. In fact, he was over the title of the film he was shooting. At the time, we were drugging and partying and drinking and doing everything. So for a while, nobody would touch me because all of a sudden when Adolph and I, we used to be the people that say, well, the party didn't start till Charles and Adolph got there.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. But now I wasn't invited. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, gosh.
And I went through that period where I wasn't getting any auditions. I wasn't getting any jobs, and I had a friend that had a trucking company. It wasn't a big company. He had maybe a couple of diesels, and he lived in Bakersfield, matter of fact. And I went on a couple of trips with him and learned how to drive a big rig, and I used one of his trucks to get my license so I could work. Because I wasn't working at the time, I was making nice money on residuals because I'd worked quite a bit. This was like 86, 87.
Gotcha.
And I got a job driving cross country. And it was a freeing experience because I was on my own in a big Freightliner cab over with a 51-foot trailer. And I had to learn all the truck things, you know, the lingo, my CV. I had played a character called the Great Mac Daddy.
Okay.
He was the son of the Big Mac Daddy, who was bad, making me the greatest daddy of all the Mac Daddies who could do anything in this world. So I gave myself the moniker of Mac Daddy.
Nice.
And the white boys would all say, "Come back, Big Daddy," and I'd go, "Mac Daddy, Mac Daddy." But what it did is let me know, because I would be out sometimes 3 months at a time,
you know,
just loading and dropping and doing stuff. And I didn't drink. I didn't do nothing. And I realized during that time that I didn't have to have it. So in a lot of ways, it saved my life. It was an experience that I cherish. I really cherish. A friend of mine that does shows around the country, Randall Myler, he puts shows together based on real life stuff. And he listened to my stories of being on that truck, and he put a show together. And we did it at the Denver Center. It's been about 8-10 years ago now, called Mama Hated Diesels.
Ah, that's what that is. Okay.
This will give you the time when I was driving trucks. The first time I heard Whitney Houston sing, "Oh, I want to dance with somebody, I want to make the heat with somebody," I was driving that truck.
Yeah, okay,
and
86.
I remember dropping off down into El Paso, Texas. I'll never forget this until the day I die. And it was 6-7 o'clock in the morning. It was a beautiful morning, and the sun was bopping off those colored rocks. And then, you know, my TV was on, and the song came on, "I'll Be Back in the Highlights." Yeah. And I started crying.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, not coming out of my nose. I'm going, "What the hell am I doing? I'm driving a goddamn truck. I'm an actor, man." Oh, God. Yeah, that's a true story. Yeah.
Gosh.
It was a rough period in my life. I got a job from that, though. You know how life is so different, man. I remember my agent calling me. I was in Memphis. And he said, "Charles, they want to see you for this new series. And this is the pilot. They want to see you." And I said, "Well, I'm in Memphis," which is like a two-day thing. He says, "Okay, I'll see if I can get you in, but you got to be here in 2 days. This was like in 89. I'd been driving for 3 years, so I knew how to run 2 books. You know, so if you ever got stopped at, you know, way station or something, you could show which book
right
up to date for that particular time. I didn't get stopped. I made it all the way to Burbank, and I pulled up outside the studio, which was in a big building that was maybe 10 stories, and I double parked my rig outside, you know, with the lights blinking, and I went up and my maybe 6-7 guys around the table, and it's, "Hey, Charles, how are you?" And the whole thing, we met. And I said, "Man, I'm sorry I look like this." I said, "I've been driving a diesel, man." He said, "You drove a diesel?" I said, yeah, it's parked right outside." And one of the guys got up and he walked to the window and he looked down at my truck. And his brother was one of the producers. And he looked at his brother. I didn't know the guy was his brother at the time. He said, come here. And they both looked down at my truck and he was like, "We used to drive trucks." I didn't even have to audition. I got the job. I got the job simply because my truck was downstairs. You know? And I shot the pilot. The pilot didn't go, but there you go again. You know? I got a job because I was a truck driver.
That is too much. That is cool.
It's been amazing. It's been an amazing journey. It really has been an amazing journey.
I'd say.
You know, I ended up marrying a girl that turned into a big soap opera star. My life has been crazy.
I'd say.
You know, all my ex-wives are still my good friends.
Oh, good. I guess I'd love to hear about when you played in the same episode, same TV show, you played both a threatening man named Hacker and the beautiful, beautiful Miss Wallace. We're talking about Sanford and Son here.
Oh, buddy.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Ms. Wallace. Didn't miss by much. That was Red. That was Red Fox. That was not in the script either. He said, well, I said, hi, I'm Ms. Wallace. You didn't miss by much. And I broke, right? I started laughing. He, clap, 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 clap. And the director said, you got to be ready for Red, okay? Because he'll go off script on you and go, okay, I'm ready. Yeah, that was fun. That was fun. And they play it all the time. And that's the only Red Fox I did. The only show of Red Fox I did. But they must play it a lot because I still get a lot of reviews from it.
It's a memorable one. And so for folks who haven't seen it, you're a robber, a thief of some sort. And then later on, you come back in drag.
I think I got the role because most of the guys that went out for this role were gay. And they didn't want a gay guy. I was a gangster disguised as a woman.
Yeah.
And I guess they saw that. I think that's why I got the job. It's a difference. There's definitely a difference when I look at it. And every once in a while, somebody will send me a part of it. Somebody will put it on social media, and I'll look at it, and I'll go like, maybe that's what it is, you know, because you can see that I'm putting on an act.
Right, right. Yes. Folks,
you know, but Red was cool. He was a friend of my sister Ann, and I told him he started me in this business.
Mm.
And I hadn't met him before. I had met him years before at Ann's house. Mm. But when I told you I was living there working in the clothing thing, I was staying with Ann, and Red Fox was a friend. I think they had some kind of little thing going, but that wasn't my business. But he was funny then, because if I was around, he would, you know, make me laugh, and his whole thing would be like, oh, you going to stay around, huh? You ain't got nowhere to go. And he told me when we were doing, we shot two shows, and then they picked the best out of those shows. He said to me, when he saw me in the dress and all made up and stuff, he said, you look just like Ann.
Did you?
Yeah. I did. Oh, I look just like Ann.
People need to go find that one. And one thing about Red, I knew him first as a kid with Sanford and Son, but then later on, it wasn't until much later, I have to admit, that I heard some of his comedy, some of his stand-up. He gave some of the bluest material. I mean,
oh, no doubt.
Up there with Richard Pryor.
That's how I knew Red Fox. Red Fox was, you know, blue. He got down in the dirt.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, with so many of the other roles on TV, just folks, they can't help but have seen you because through the 70s and through the 80s and well beyond, let's say through my childhood and well into my adultery, I saw you on nearly every cop show I could think of. Kojak, The Rockford Files, Dukes of San Francisco.
Willie.
Yes.
People remember Shotgun Willie of a certain age.
Yeah.
I have anonymity now because I haven't done a lot of TV in the last 10 years. I've been running this theater company for 15 years. I'm planning on taking a break anytime now.
Mm.
You have to, at a certain age, I mean, the younger actors, they call me OG.
Yeah.
It's like old gangster.
Yeah, original gangster.
It's a very endearing thing.
Absolutely.
By giving me credit for what I've done, you know. Every once in a while, you catch somebody that looks and says, hey, man, that's what used to happen to me when I drove that truck. Because at that time, I was pretty well known. I mean,
right.
They didn't know my name, but my face.
Yeah.
So I would be at a truck stop, and I would always get, hey, man. Did you used to be an actor? Man, hey, did you used to be an actor? I go, yeah.
Did you say yes or no, but I play one on TV?
Yeah,
or?
No. I used to be an actor. I went along with it. What the hell did you say? I wasn't then. I was driving a truck. I was living in Venice, and I came in off the road. I took the trailer off and drove the tractor in, parked it out where I always parked. You couldn't park it on the street I lived, but you could park it on one of the, like, Venice Boulevard. And I walked around to my, I had a little bungalow that was fenced in. And I listened to my messages, which was like maybe a month or so. So it was a lot of messages. At that time, you had to tape. And one of the messages was from Douglas Turner Ward. And Douglas was, Charles, give me a call. See if you can come back. And we got something for you. And I couldn't sleep. So this is a nice little story. True story, of course. I couldn't sleep. It was about 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock California time, which was 10 o'clock New York time. I figured Doug was in the office. And I called, and he picked up the phone. He says, yeah, listen, I want you to do this place. He said, we're going to open it in University of Arizona at a new theater that they had just built. And he told me the date, which was probably about a month away. And he told me everybody was going to be in it. And then they flew me in. I got to the airport, and Samuel L. Jackson and a friend of mine named, we call him Mom, Iris Little Thomas, picked me up at the airport. And when Sam saw me, he started crying, and I started crying. And he said, I thought you were dead.
Way to go, Sam.
I thought you were dead, man. We both had tears in our eyes because nobody had heard from me, man. I was on that diesel. I was out on that truck. I just disappeared.
Wow,
I'm remembering all this stuff now.
I would really appreciate you sharing this one. Before going into NPR, I grew up a theater person, and I've done a few David Mamet shows, and I noticed that, and I'm from Kentucky, by the way, and I've actually worked at Actors Theater of Louisville, and I noticed, I noticed that you were in Glengarry Glen Ross at ATL. Now, I have to say, I have very much a love-hate relationship with David Mamet, and that is because of the language. It's so precise and so real, and so it's foul, too. I mean,
it's
if a person
to do,
is...
David.
Well, one, it's a return to the stage as opposed to film, but immersing yourself in David Mamet and just... I know how I tackle it. How do you? How did you approach this? Because
it was hard. It was really hard. I mean, the guy that was the artistic director at the time directed that piece, and it was different. I mean, I couldn't just do what I normally did because it was almost a pentameter on it.
Yes.
It was like it had to go a certain way to make it work.
Yes.
That's the way he wrote, and I had never did a David Mamet before. I'd heard about him, of course.
Sure.
So I really had to buckle down and listen to my director. But you know who helped me out? His name is William Maypother. William Maypother is Tom Cruise's first cousin. Tom Cruise's name is Maypother.
Okay. Never knew that.
William is his first cousin.
Okay.
So his whole family is from the Louisville area. So I got to meet his aunties and all these people, you know. But William Maypother had done Mamet before, and he was just a big help to me. We still stay in touch on social media. I think he lives in L.A. now. I don't think he lived there. I think he came back to work there.
Gotcha.
I'd never met Tom Cruise, but I met his cousins, his aunties. I think I met his mom. I'm not sure. But I met a lot of Maypothers. But that's a really hard play to do. And I played the character that's one of the best lines in the whole play when he leaves. Well, it's the word. You can't use the word.
It's been Charles Weldon for the entirety of tonight's KVC Arts. I'd met Charles through a concert put on by Affordable Music Productions and was thinking about the next concert coming up and some of my favorite conversations from the past. The next concert through Affordable Music Productions, by the way, is one that was set for June of last year and then postponed until August of last year and then postponed again. And I know that there are changes to the upcoming concert, but details are being worked out. Go to affordablemusicproductions.com for the latest updates. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Charles Weldon and to Nathan Goethals of Affordable Music Productions for initially getting me in touch with Charles. And thanks to Patty McGill for the photo op. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Sharina Watt, and Andrew Caravella. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.